How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Michael. Starting today, The Daily is revisiting our favorite episodes of the year, listening back and hearing what's happened in the time since they first ran. Up first, a story from this spring, when New York City was the epicenter of the pandemic. It's Thursday, December 24th.
Good morning. Hi. So every morning in the intensive care unit at the Brooklyn Hospital Center, the doctors gather for something called morning report. Okay.
So now I want you all to present in a very clear way.
The people who were on overnight, they stand around and the head doctor is there and they kind of give a report of what happened. And then the new doctors who are coming on, they get that information.
Yeah, when she was at rest this morning, she was breathing 23. She's very comfortable. Thumbs up.
They talk about, you know, who was admitted, who got critically ill.
The overnight patient is not doing well, so she had to be reintubated almost immediately.
And one recent morning report was particularly intense.
Okay, all right, okay. Next patient.
There were patients in their 80s and patients in their 30s.
30-week segment, asthma, obesity, admitted to the ICU. She was intubated yesterday evening.
All right, good. Next.
There were patients from nursing homes and patients who were homeless.
She was intubated overnight. She's on azithromycin, clofazimine, ceftriaxone.
Okay, next.
Patients with asthma and diabetes and patients with no underlying conditions at all. But as the doctors raced to get through the cases,
next patient,
they all shared a nearly identical description.
He was upgraded for acute hypoxic respiratory failure.
Okay, next.
Male acute hypoxic respiratory failure secondary to confirmed COVID.
All right, next.
Admitted for acute hypoxic respiratory failure with confirmed COVID-19.
Next.
Admitted for acute hypoxic respiratory failure.
Acute hypoxic respiratory failure secondary to COVID-19.
All right, next.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, it's been more than a month since the coronavirus descended on New York City's hospitals and on Brooklyn Hospital Center, where the vast majority of patients in critical care have the virus. My colleague Sherry Fink has been reporting from the hospital with the permission of staff, patients, and their families, and brings us the story of a single day there. It's Thursday, December 24th.
Morning, everybody.
Josh, do you want to spend a little? This is Sherry.
Sure.
She's with the New York Times, and she's going to spend some time here a little bit.
Pleasure.
It's up to you.
I'm fine with a physician.
So for the past few weeks, I've been embedded in the Brooklyn Hospital Center.
I'm going to finish rounding here, and then I'm going to go downstairs and cover SI.
And okay. What I've been able to see there is incredibly unique. What's happening? What is it like inside a hospital during a pandemic?
Okay.
Do you want to give him your mic, or are you willing to wear a...
And there was one doctor I met who really embodied that transparency.
Does it beep every time I say a four-letter word like South Park?
Dr. Josh Rosenberg.
I am mildly inappropriate. I am just warning you.
An attending physician in the intensive care unit.
How are you, Peter? I didn't see you hiding over there, my friend.
There are people from all over the hospital recruited to work in the ICU. So it's not just like ICU doctors and nurses who are used to intensive care treatment, but in fact...
And she's one of the podiatry residents. So all people who are good with knives and big needles.
When I was there that day, there was a podiatry doctor and two of her residents. Those are doctors who work on the feet.
No. What I would like to do is that as much as possible, we're going to try to get all the COVIDs on one side, and then the whole area is a dirty area.
And the ICU had actually effectively doubled in size, so it was completely full, and they had to turn to other areas of the hospital to turn them into intensive care units. In fact, a big part of the ICU is now in a place that just a few weeks ago was where patients would come for outpatient chemotherapy treatments. That's now an ICU.
Thank you. Watch out. Don't trip.
It was also a bit of an obstacle course.
Don't trip.
There were cords everywhere.
Please be careful. Do you have gloves?
They had pulled apart the ventilators. They had the control parts of the ventilators that were helping people breathe. Those were in the hallways so that nurses and respiratory therapists didn't have to go in and out as much and expose themselves to risk.
What?
This is a disaster waiting to happen.
Yes and no, though.
And the nurses were doing the same thing with IVs, with the tubing that the medicine flows through. So they had pulled the IV pumps out of the room so that they could not have to go in and out and use up the personal protective equipment.
It's great. And yeah, I mean, you can trip over
all,
it.
You all have to be very careful.
You just have to be careful.
Yeah.
All right. It's making the best of what you can do.
Yep.
Okay, guys, can we start with number two? I appreciate everybody being here and everybody's support massively.
So now Dr. Rosenberg is taking over for the doctors who were working the night before, and he's beginning to make his rounds.
Let's start with number two and then just go around the unit, please. All right, so lucky number two.
So nearly all the patients in the ICU are on ventilators.
So do we have any history of smoking, shisha use, anything like that?
Some have asthma, some have diabetes.
All right. What did he do for a living? Occupational exposure?
But a lot of these patients don't have any underlying conditions at all.
I'm just right, because, I mean, listen, on some of these, you have a real reason why, you know, they may have bad lungs and that makes it worse. Sometimes it's just the disease, but if there's something we can do to...
So Josh and the other doctors are kind of confounded by some of the patients. They don't understand why, if they don't have a lot of underlying health issues, why their lungs look so bad.
Crap. Poor dude. Any asthma?
And they also just don't have that much to offer.
Okay, so what are we going to do with him?
Right now, at this point, I'm not actually sure what we can do with him. We tried to have some of those in the lab.
So what is he on drug-wise?
So, I mean, for most patients, they're trying this thing called the COVID cocktail, which is that hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. That's that combination the president talks about a lot.
I don't think it's doing much.
But there's really very little evidence, and Dr. Rosenberg in particular is very unsure that those drugs really help.
We'll see about remdesivir. We'll see if we can get some COVID results and see what we can do.
So they start talking about other possibilities. There's this experimental drug called remdesivir that you have to apply to the manufacturer for each patient, and they have to meet certain criteria. You have to have a test result. They can't have certain complications.
How do you guys feel about Kaletra? Or other PIs.
There's another drug called Kaletra that doctors think might have some effect.
The data is very weak all over the place. That's the basic problem. So I always look at it as, where are you starting these drugs? It's near the end of the sporting event. You're down by a lot. I don't care who you throw out there, right? Even freaking Jordan couldn't recover that basketball game outside of Space Jam when you're down by 100 points and starting the fourth quarter.
That's why I don't think we should be giving a temer to patients who are already in ARDS.
So they kind of toss this around.
Yeah, and so we don't know. I mean, this is the problem. We really just don't know our data. But, like, so looking at this, yeah. So we'll figure out, we'll see if we can get the remdesivir, which I doubt we'll be able to. We'll try to get a positive test result. Next, let's move on along. Okay, ICU 6. Going for C-section?
Supposedly today, yeah.
There was another COVID patient in the intensive care unit on a ventilator, and she was pregnant which adds a whole layer of complexity.
She needs another dose of Decadron and then...
Decadron? No, beclomethasone.
Oh, sorry. Did I say Decadron? Yeah.
Yes.
And they actually decided to deliver the baby by C-section 2 months before the due date. They had to give a couple of doses of steroid medication to help mature the baby's lungs. The whole goal was to save the mother's life, because I think part of it is that it gives more space for the lungs to expand once the baby is taken out.
So if she's going for C-section, then she won't be rendezvous, right?
I have no clue.
So far, what's known is it tends to be quite rare that a baby would be born with COVID if the mom has it. At least that's what the early studies say.
All right. Number four. How are we doing here?
It might be surprising how enthusiastic Dr. Rosenberg sounds while discussing these patients. But he's leading this team. He's trying to keep morale up.
So... All right, so I'm going to stop here and head downstairs. Evgeny's going to take 679. Thank you. I will circle in with you guys. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good job.
So it's just,
but actually, when we were going from one part of the ICU to another...
Let's go downstairs. I don't like taking the elevators.
He runs into one of his medical students.
Hi, guys.
How are you doing, buddy?
Best I can.
One, shouldn't you be home? Shouldn't you be home?
My mom's here.
Oh, fuck.
I know.
Which bed is she in that side?
She's in 10.
Okay, I'm rounding here now.
Okay. May I speak to you at some point today when you have a chance?
Call me at any point, all right?
Thanks, Doc.
I'll see you later. Call me if you need anything, in all seriousness. You have my cell, right? Perfect. He's one of our medical students. He's been here forever. So we sent home all the medical students that rotate with us very early in this crisis, because I kind of looked at this and I said, one, we don't have enough PPE, you know, for all the medical students that are coming through. And two, you know, I hate to say it like this, like, I don't want to expose them. They have enough time to get the living daylight scared out of them. let them actually be students for a bit. Next patient, Santos.
Yeah, so this is our, she's our 54-year-old female, history of hypertension, came here with shortness of breath, fevers, admitted for acute hypoxia.
She's the mom of our med student, right?
Yes, she's confirmed positive COVID.
And when we get to this medical student's mom, things are not looking good.
Her FiO2 has been hovering between the 100 to 80. Just want to make sure you know that
she's not doing well. I'll speak to the son. I know him pretty well.
Yeah,
is he the next of kin? Is he the next of kin? He's the decision maker?
And Dr. Rosenberg wants to find out, is the son, is the medical student, the one who will be making decisions about her further treatment, about even possibly end-of-life care?
But is he giving us consents? Or does she have a husband?
Yeah.
This is going to be hard. He knows. He's a smart kid.
I mean, to me, it sounded like he feels that this medical student, even though he's still a student, is enough of a doctor to understand that the prognosis isn't great, that perhaps his mom has some risk factors for this being more severe and for her to possibly not make it.
He's a good dude. He's a very sweet man. So we'll figure it out.
Of course, when it's your family member, it's not so simple.
All right, here.
There are many cases where the doctors and the patient's families have very different views of how to proceed with treatment.
COVID?
Yeah. Well, it's pending, but most likely.
Okay. So his pulmonary prognosis is horrible, right?
Yes.
He's not getting better.
No,
blood gas is...
not good at all.
Not good, and he's on 100%.
Yes.
So what does the fam want us to do?
Family wants us to continue treatment. They agree to be in our...
Where the family still wants to press forward with all the intensive care available.
Right. So how many organ systems do we have down on him? We have our kidneys are down, our respiratory system's down. He's out. Cardiovascular is bad. He's on multi-organ system failure, right? So I have three out of my systems down already. His prognosis at that point, given his disease state, is just poor, unfortunately.
and where the doctors had come to a different conclusion and really felt like there wasn't much hope, and that, in fact, the goals of care should shift away from trying to extend life and much more toward comfort and end of life, accepting that the patient was likely going to die.
And I hate to say it like this, but I don't know what I'm able really to offer in terms of getting him back to where he was before. Next.
Check the vitals from there too. You can hit the button.
Suddenly we hear this announcement go out over the hospital loudspeaker saying code blue.
Code blue 6B.
Josh.
Which means that somebody needs to be resuscitated, that they are basically dying.
Okay, it's code blue. You're on outreach or Reza?
Reza.
Okay.
Can we follow you?
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for the New York Times covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe. So the code blue, it turned out, wasn't for a COVID patient, but for a patient who had other medical problems. And they did CPR, and the patient survived. And for me, the moment was really just highlighting the fact that in a hospital, that work goes on, that there are all these other patients, too, who have different medical problems, and people are still having other emergencies. So hospitals can't just stop being hospitals for everybody else. But it's hard because the number of patients with COVID is increasing. Usually, if you have people with a scary infectious disease, you would put them in specific rooms in the hospital. But of course, now there's many more patients than there are isolation rooms. So I think the doctors are very concerned about this possibility that somebody could come into the hospital for something else.
Is COVID negative?
And then, you know, catch COVID there. That's the real worst case scenario.
She's not a COVID issue?
Not really, no.
Let's try to get her the heck out of this unit, please. Okay, get her out. EVD prophylaxis.
But of course, one of the big risks is to be a person who is walking into that hospital every day to work there.
Hello, Dr. Rosenberg speaking. I was paged.
And in fact, at one point,
yes.
Dr. Rosenberg gets word that one of his residents,
he has COVID,
tested positive for COVID, and is in the emergency room downstairs.
Thanks. All right. What's up? You have his x-ray up? Okay, I'll look at it in 2 seconds.
Someone pulls up an x-ray of the resident's lungs for him to look at, and he peels off his personal protective equipment, which in this case includes his own ski goggles, and he looks at the x-ray. And immediately, the tone shifts.
That's shitty. I don't like that. I want him here. He is one to come up. He comes right up because he's high risk for getting intubated.
Yeah.
What he sees on the x-ray is something that looks bad to him.
That's what I'm worried about because his x-ray looks crappy.
Yeah.
No.
Let's just go back.
He's one of our surgical residents. Bring him to the ICU. Bring him here. Don't dilly.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying.
I think what was really striking to him, or what sort of like shocked him, was that this was another doctor.
That is ours. That is one of us.
And close to his age, and somebody who's been doing the same kind of work that he's doing every day. And I think that shatters that sense of invulnerability.
This is insanity. For my first day out, after being back from a week from this crap, holy shit.
I actually found out partway through that day that Dr. Rosenberg himself had been out the previous week with symptoms of COVID. He actually didn't get a test until his symptoms had resolved, and it turned out to be negative. But he's pretty sure he had COVID.
Well, one of the things we'll discuss at nurse hunting, we need more nurses.
And this is a huge problem. A third of the doctors and nurses were out sick. A number of them had tested positive for COVID and were critically ill. And it's not just a problem for this hospital. It's a problem all over New York City, that as the hospitals are overwhelmed with COVID patients, you have high numbers of health staff out sick.
Thank you for taking the time for being here today. As governor of New York, I am asking healthcare professionals across the country, if you don't have a healthcare crisis in your community, please come help us in New York now.
The day that I was at the hospital, New York Governor Cuomo pleaded for doctors and nurses and healthcare staff from around the U.S. to come to New York.
We need relief. We need relief for doctors. We need relief for attendants.
In part to help fill in for the workers who are falling ill across the state.
So if you're not busy, come help us, please.
Hey. Hey, he's going to be in ICU 12, okay? No, not yet. They're about to bring him out shortly, but we're getting everything done. I know. I know. Trust me, it's freaky. He's only 5 years younger than me. You know? I'm 45. Like half of our patients upstairs, we have 40-year-olds who are intubated. Jesus. Jeez. Oh. And this is brutal. All right, good. I just want to let you know where it would be. All right? You got it. I'll see you later. Bye. I am tired.
We'll be right back.
Hey, football fans. I'm Diana Rossini, senior NFL insider at The Athletic, part of the New York Times. I recently started the podcast Scoop City with my good friend Chase Daniel. He played backup quarterback for 7 different pro football franchises over 14 years. Our close access to football people helps us keep you in the know all season long. New episodes of Scoop City drop every Tuesday and Friday from The Athletic. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Last week, Daily producer Daniel Guillemette called back Dr. Rosenberg for an update.
Hello?
Hi, Dr. Rosenberg. How are you doing?
Good.
Are you at the hospital right now?
Oh, yes. So I'm standing in the vaccine queue.
Oh,
we're
wow.
Socially distant, 6 feet apart. Employees and everybody are talking to each other, saying hi to one another.
It does sound very, very jovial in the background, which is great to hear.
I don't want to use the word jovial. but people are happy to get this vaccine. They want to get this vaccine. They want to protect themselves. They want to protect their patients. You know, and the mood is not somber. Mood is that a lot of people are somewhat excited and somewhat nervous. It's a new vaccine. They know that, but they're excited to move progress forward, move the health of the nation forward, and be start of something that's larger than themselves. And so it's, you know, kind of monumentous to be part of this. To me, this harkens back to the 50s in certain ways, where you had the lines for polio vaccination extended out. Well, here in the hospital, we have a long corridor, and you have this line of employees to get vaccinated, extending down this corridor, much like the old polio vaccine queues were. I'm next. So I'm on the phone currently with the Times.
Okay. So they want to hear you scream? Is that the
apparently. Squeal like a little girl. Yeah. All right, let's go.
Do you have any questions, Jeff?
No, I'm good. I think I should have read everything.
Exactly. All right. Okay.
All right, tell me what's going on.
Little pinch, we're done. No pain from the vaccine whatsoever. All right. Give me 2 seconds. Let me just save something, go to someplace a little less loud.
All right, while you're doing that, let me ask you, in terms of COVID cases at the hospital, how are things going?
It's calmed down a fair amount. We are seeing an increasing in COVID cases specifically. Our ICU is almost full. We have a couple empty beds. As time's gone on, we've learned a lot more about the disease. And the truth is we're now finally having some semblance of might work, might not work. And to be honest, a fair amount of, we still don't have a solid idea. But we're months out and we've had time to develop some newer drugs and treatments, and the vaccines are now coming right out of the blocks. Means that there has been a fair amount of success in trying to slow this, although it may not be to the degree that we'd like.
Is the death rate at your hospital different compared to the spring?
It is. It is lower. We still, unfortunately, have some people in their 50s and 60s who have passed away from it during this time, this recent time. That being said, there are a fair number of patients who I think are recovering and going home who might not otherwise. There was one recent patient we had where their family members were actually able to get one of the newer antibody treatments. And that's an option that just didn't exist back then.
If anything, what do you still not have enough of?
I mean, we're very good in terms of equipment. We're good in terms of medications because we don't have the same citywide crunch on medications that we did back then. What happened back then is that everybody suddenly needed a lot of everything, and the supplies were limited. So hospitals got rationing, which was appropriate at the time, but we ran out of things. We have enough of the sedatives that we needed before. We have enough of the vasopressors that we occasionally ran out of before. We're in very, very good shape. But if we have a surge like we did in April and it's as bad as it is, and it's that bad in other cities, I could definitely see a run on medication. So there's just a limited supply of those nationwide. So if everybody suddenly needs increased volumes, we'll be in trouble. Same thing with all the various types of PPE. We're in very good supply now, but if everybody across the nation suddenly needs a tremendous, tremendous amount of stuff, absolutely supply lines could get tight. So there's always those supply-demand issues that can happen. That being said, I don't see a particular item that I think is going to be a problem point.
What about staffing?
Staffing's always always a question mark. And if you have a high index of sick calls, yes, staffing will become an issue again. There's just nothing you can do about that. If a third of your workforce is out sick, a third of your workforce is out sick.
I guess, though, the fact of hospital staff getting vaccinated now should reduce the risk of people being sick.
I was one of the lucky ones that was enabled to kind of be near the head of the line, which I greatly appreciate because I do have a daily exposure to patients who are COVID positive by the nature of the work. And so we tried to hit up those who work in those areas where we have COVID positive patients frequently, in the emergency room, the ICUs, the medical floors, housekeeping in / environmental services, the floors where those people work where they tend to have exposures. And we got a good turnout for it. And I think vaccine acceptance has overall been very high.
Okay, so with the hospital staff getting vaccinations, I guess I wonder, is there like a lighter mood or something at the hospital? Like, do things like amongst the staff, is there just like a sort of a sense of relief or something?
There is a light.
Yeah.
There is a light, yes. There is a sense of relief that this may finally be coming to an end. This darkness, maybe, just maybe, the craziness and the utter insanity that was last winter and everything else. There's a light at the end of the tunnel, and it's coming to an end. And the vaccine's that first step in really getting disease under control, if people are willing to take it. Just, you know, as a doctor and a scientist, it's to me still mind-blowing that they could create an effective, safe vaccine in that little time and get it out to all of us. Is to me mind-blowing, because I know how long it took to do all these other vaccines in history. And so it's really a sense of awe at that. And I'm, you know, kind of just taken aback by it.
Listen, thank you so much for making some time, and, you know, good luck with the rest of your day. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
Today's episode was produced by Annie Brown, Daniel Guimet, and Claire Tennisketter, with help from Alexandra Lee Young and Sydney Harper. It was edited by Lisa Chow, Liz O'Balin, Lisa Tobin, and Paige Cowett, and engineered by Chris Wood and Dan Powell. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you on Monday after the holiday.